Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. China and Taiwan have held their highest-level talks since the end of the Civil War in 1949. For the first time, both sides have sent ministers to negotiate. The Taipei delegation was led by Wang Yuqi, and the Beijing representative was Zhang Jijun.
It's impossible to imagine that we could sit here and meet, but we must have some kind of imagination if we want to overcome our difficulties. We also must think bigger about cross-strait future development.
That was Beijing's representative at the meeting in Nanjing between Taiwan and China, Zhang Jiyun. The meeting, of course, in Taiwan is being played out differently. Taiwan's opposition, the Democratic Progressive Party, is seeing this as, well, nothing new and nothing's really going to come out of it. Here's a former Taiwan Vice President, Anita Liu.
They attack Taiwan, they seduce Taiwan, and then they begin to swallow Taiwan. We worry most that if this year, when APEC is held in Beijing, and President Ma and President Xi have a chance to meet, and even a secret deal is arranged, then that will be terrible.
To find out more, we have this report from Karen Snowden.
Taiwan news agency CNA has quoted Wang Yuqi as saying the visit would not be easy, but he hoped it would go smoothly. Emeritus Professor of Asian Studies at Monash University, Bruce Jacobs, is playing down the significance of these talks.
It's one of a series of meetings that's been ongoing between Taiwan and China for many years. So even though the representative from Taiwan is now an official minister, I wouldn't characterize this as unprecedented at all.
It's been 65 years since the nationalist Kuomintang fled to Taiwan under Chiang Kai-shek. The two sides have not signed a peace agreement, and Communist China maintains that Taiwan is a renegade part of the mainland, that it will recover eventually. But economic, travel and education links have increased rapidly under Taiwan's Beijing-friendly leader, Ma Ying-jeou. Two-way trade is approaching $200 billion a year. David Huang from a leading Taiwan think tank, Academia Sinica, agrees the first meeting is symbolic, but Beijing is pushing things in a political direction.
Well, I think this is basically more like a photo opportunities, or it's kind of a PR, you know. But from the Beijing side, Beijing would like to see that maybe the government-to-government talk would facilitate the Beijing's agenda of the political dialogues. So both sides of government obviously have their own agenda.
This process will be closely watched as to whether it signals Beijing's loosening of its opposition to Ma Ying-jeou attending the APEC summit, which is in Beijing later this year. Last year, President Xi Jinping said China is willing to hold talks with Taiwan on an equal basis under the One China principle, and their problems should not be handed down to future generations. Bruce Jacobs says one hurdle is Ma Ying-jeou's inconsistency.
And I think one of the concerns about this meeting is that sort of doubt. I mean, he said on one occasion that Taiwan is sovereign. Another occasion he said that Taiwan is part of the Republic of China. He's on occasion said that the Republic of China, which was the government that ruled China before the People's Republic, still controls both Taiwan and the mainland. So what he actually believes is a bit unclear.
David Huang considers the meeting as the possible first step towards an eventual meeting between the leaders. Whether that's at APEC or some other occasion, it would carry large implications.
For example, Beijing would like Taiwan to sit up to talk about peace agreements, or maybe end of the military hostilities agreements, or maybe to talk about the confidence building, military confidence building agreements. And these sorts of very highly sensitive issues will always involve the regional power balance in the Asia-Pacific. I think that that will be of concern of the all international communities.
One of the issues Taiwan's negotiators are being pressed to raise is press freedom. In response to Beijing's refusal to accredit several media organizations to cover the talks.
Karen Snowden reporting. Japan and the United States have been talking about the future of the 26,000 American troops based on the island of Okinawa for years. It's deeply unpopular with locals, but both Japan and the United States are committed to strong military presence in the region as China's power grows. So Carolyn Kennedy, the newly appointed U.S. envoy to Japan and daughter of the late U.S. President JFK, visited Okinawa to try to win support for a relocation plan. Matthew Carney has the story.
On her first visit to Okinawa, Carolyn Kennedy visited a memorial to honour the 240,000 that were killed towards the end of World War II. It's a painful history, and the ambassador chose her words carefully about the relocation of the U.S. base.
Seeing so many students at the museum was really, I think, a great reminder of the importance of working together to reduce the burden of the American military presence here so that we can build a future for the students of Okinawa and create opportunities for them.
Ms. Kennedy met with the Okinawa governor, Hirokazu Nikashima, who only last December changed his position to support the move.
We have about 50,000 U.S. military personnel and their families. There can be problems like crime, accidents, and environmental issues. We would like to ask for your help to resolve the fundamental issues and reduce our burden of having U.S. bases.
The majority of people in Okinawa have remained fiercely opposed to any U.S. base since three soldiers raped and abducted a 12-year-old Chinese girl in 1995. Local resident Kazuri Nakamura.
We as the Okinawan people gave our answers many times that we don't want military bases here.
The plan is to move the U.S. base from the city of Jiawen to the remote area of Nagao, but the locals say the construction will destroy the unique ecology of the area. The Japanese and the U.S. government say the base must be built, and it's critical in countering increased Chinese naval aggression and an unpredictable North Korea.
Matthew Carney reporting. Well, Indonesia will be heading to the polls soon to elect a new president. One of those hopefuls happens to be Gitna Wijayanan. He was formerly the trade minister of Indonesia. Now, Indonesia has many political parties that are running from many different religious groups and different organizations. But what makes Gitna very different is that, well, first his age and his new vision for the Indonesian economy. He speaks next to Australia Network's Jim Middleton.
Gitna Wijayanan, good to be talking to you again.
Hi, Jim. Good to talk to you again and see you.
He who is not courageous enough to take risks will accomplish nothing in life. That's a quote from Muhammad Ali, and you used it as you announced your candidacy. You are very much the underdog in this contest, are you not?
Yes, I am. I am an underdog, and I'm relatively new in this political process. But as Muhammad Ali said, you've got to take some risks in life.
And what do you think you bring to the table? What do you have that the other candidates in this crowded contest do not?
Well, I bring an array of attributes, one of which is my experience in working in the government a little over 4 years. I've seen how things have gone well, and I've seen how things have not gone as well as they should have. So far, Indonesia has been known for having a swing vote of 35 to 40%, and most of these swing votes are people that are youthful, and these are people who probably would have been resentful of the politicians and political process, and I offer I think somewhat of a different aura or color, and I'm hopeful that these people will gravitate to what I have to offer.
What has not gone as well as it should in Indonesia, as you said a few moments ago? What would you like to change? What would be your priorities?
Well, I think if we take a look at how democracy has fared in Indonesia, I think it's fared really well in the last 16 years. I think many people are surprised with how well we have democratized. While at the same time, we've been able to grow our economy, almost five times in the last 9 years. And that is, I think, a testament to how the government has been doing certain things or many things right. But with a qualification of a number of things, one of which is really the lack of equity with which we have grown, and we've seen only some parts of Indonesia growing a little faster or much faster than others, and our inability to basically have energy and food security in some areas, and those are things that I think could be done better going forward.
You see yourself as something of a reformer. You'd like to see fewer politicians in cabinet, more technocrats. Does that suggest you'd like to reboot the economic reforms that President Yudhoyono instituted in his first term? That's nearly 10 years ago now. And have languished somewhat during his second term?
Well, I'm a believer of having professionals in the cabinet, technocrats or professionals who I think should be in charge of the economy, the economic variables of the cabinet or decision making in the cabinet, and I'm a believer of that.
How important and how urgent is it for Indonesia to speed up action on some of the problems facing your country? Corruption, regulation, red tape, poor infrastructure, all of these are significant and intractable problems on which action has slowed down in recent years.
Well, I think on the corruption front, I've been quite vocal about it, particularly with respect to the Corruption Eradication Committee, which I think has been a proven success in terms of helping eradicate corruption. But the numbers tell the story. We only have 100 investigators versus 4.5 million public officials in the country. So the ratio of 1 to 45,000 is not going to help us in eradicating corruption fast enough. While we saw in Hong Kong they had a ratio of investigators to public officials of 1 to 200 versus ours, which is 1 to 45,000. So I think it's a question of the extent to which the chief executive would like to commit additional funding in terms of increasing the number of investigators within the Corruption Eradication Committee. Now, in terms of building infrastructure, that also is a factor of corruption that takes place at center and also in the regions. But my idea for regional autonomy is quite simply related to how we decentralize our fiscal space. And I think there needs to be a lot more rewards and punishments within the way or means we decentralize our fiscal space. We've seen schools being built in regions without students and teachers. And that, I think, is a reflection of how the local or regional leader should be reprimanded for asking for a budget with no forward thinking on getting the supply side in terms of teachers and students.
You have personal experience as a member of the president's cabinet just how hard it is to institute sensible economic reform. I'm referring, of course, to the fuel subsidy debate of last year in which you took something of a lead. But it's a very difficult thing to manage when there are entrenched attitudes and people have much to gain from what already exists, inefficient and corrupt though it may be.
I agree with you that the subsidy is an issue that we have to deal with. I don't foresee Indonesia perennially subsidizing on fuel. I think that's a variable that could be taken a view on in the coming years, depending on how fast or quickly we can enlarge our fiscal space by way of increasing our tax ratio And that is, I think, something that's quite doable in the midterm and long term. If we can achieve that, I think we can think and do more clearly in terms of reducing, if not eliminating, the fuel subsidies. Now, second, it's in regards to, I think, how more proactive we can in terms of incentivizing and getting people to do faster exploitation and exploration of our oil. If we take a look at our trade account and current account last year, it's a reflection of our, you know, high degree of reliance on importation of oil. It's around 400,000 barrels a day of oil that needs to be imported, and that's a reflection of our, you know, lack of production capability, which I think can be beefed up by way of taking a more proactive view on the exploration and exploitation of our oil reserves.
Trade was, of course, your responsibility in the cabinet. On that score, relations between Australia and Indonesia have been quite difficult in recent months. But the economic relationship has remained on an even keel, including important items like the beef trade, for example. Did you come under any pressure to cut imports of Australian beef at the height of the crisis, given the atmosphere immediately after the espionage allegations?
We have always been focused on maintaining stability of price. And the stability of price can only be attained by way of making sure that we get enough supply. I think the sad part about it is that we don't avail or produce enough of the beef that we need. We can only avail, you know, around 60% of what we need on a yearly basis. And that is, I think, something that we've got to take a view on in terms of ramping up our local supply, and it has nothing to do with, you know, the view taking on beef coming from Australia or what. And so far, we've basically found Australian beef as one of the most, if not the most, competitive supply of food or beef for Indonesia, and that, I think, shall remain. Having said that, it doesn't mean that we wouldn't be open-minded with other alternatives that could, you know, help or, you know, support our food security goals in the future.
The polls indicate that the party to which you belong, the Democrats, will struggle in the parliamentary elections this year, even to get the numbers required to enable the party to nominate a candidate for the presidency. What do you think you can do in the short time available to help turn that around and hence boost your prospects?
Well, I don't know, Jim, but I'm going to pray and I'm going to try my best in the next couple of months. Look, the reason why I chose to join the convention was mainly because this was the only party that provided a platform for young caterers like me to participate in a political process, where all the other parties are not as nearly democratic as this one is in terms of, you know, providing an opportunity for the young ones. They seem to be fixated with just one person in mind in terms of moving forward as a candidate, whereas this platform allows 11 people to huddle up and you know, let the people choose as to who of the 11 people would be moving forward.
Do you worry about the nationalist sentiment of some of the other parties' announced candidates? Do you worry what that may mean for Indonesia should they, rather than someone with your views, be elected president?
I'm not worried. I represent the young generation of Indonesia, and I know the young generation of Indonesia understands where Indonesia is. Indonesia being the third largest democracy in the world, it wants to stay on as a thriving democracy. Indonesia being the fourth largest you know, population in the world, Indonesia being the 15th largest economy in the world, aspiring to be bigger than the 15th. So I think Indonesia must stay intertwined within the international community, and it must stay relevant for Indonesia. to stay relevant within the international community, whatever nationalism that people might be hearing, I think it's a healthy kind of nationalism that's got to be internationalist.
One final question. You've mentioned repeatedly your relative youth. Some analysts in Indonesia are suggesting what you're really doing is preparing the ground not for this presidential election, but for the next one in 2019. Is that what you're really about? You still will be a relatively young man then, with much of your future still in front of you.
No, At the moment, I'm only thinking 2014, so we'll have another conversation. Ask me again in April.
Fair enough. Gita Wedjawan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Jim.
As we get closer to the date for Indonesia's elections, we'll be covering the story a lot more. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Our final story today is about Papua New Guinea. A commission of inquiry in Papua New Guinea has recommended an Australian-led company involved in obtaining leases over more than 2 million hectares of trade land be investigated for criminal misconduct and conspiracy. Landowners told the commission hearings that their land, much of it pristine rainforest, has been leased without their permission. The commission found evidence of fraud by a company called Independent Timbers Stevenboring. The plan is still to become PNG's biggest ever logging project. We have this story from Jemiah Garrett.
Papua New Guinea is used to dodgy deals, but one of the most audacious has been the rorting, mainly by logging companies, of a leasing scheme intended for small agriculture projects. In less than a decade, 11% of PNG's landmass has been leased, mostly for 99 years. In September, Prime Minister Peter O'Neill told Parliament a commission of inquiry revealed a shocking trend of corruption and mismanagement. The largest of the land grabs involved four leases for more than 2 million hectares, belonging to tens of thousands of people in PNG's western province. It was orchestrated by a small PNG-registered Queensland-led company called Independent Timbers and Stevedoring. The commission report, which has just become public, found ITNS manipulated the supposedly independent lease approval process to obtain control over four special agricultural and business leases, or SABLs. Commissioner Nicholas Moreau found documents prepared by the company were deceptive and clearly fraudulent, and recommended further investigation be undertaken to establish if international racketeering over land acquisition had been committed. Commissioner Moreau spent 2 weeks in Western Province listening to testimony from landowners and found the majority did not give consent to the leases. He says the leases should be revoked.
One of the fundamental requirements under the Lands Act itself is consent. Now, if you don't have consent of the landowners, then obviously it is the prerequisite for an SABL lease to be granted.
The ITNS project began life as a plan to build a road 600 kilometres from the western province town of Kiunga to the PNG capital, Port Moresby, and to pay for it by harvesting logs along a 40-metre road corridor. Landowners were keen for the opportunities road access would bring and happy to lease a narrow passage through the forest. But the commission found that by the time all the paperwork was finished, Lands Department officials and executives of landowner companies had unwittingly signed approval for the leasing of more than 2 million hectares. Because the leases were SABLs, the usual forestry rules forbidding clear felling did not apply. Lawrence Stevens, chairman of the PNG chapter of Transparency International, wants further investigation of Independent Timbers and Stevedoring by Australian as well as PNG authorities.
Our reaction from the start with that case was that it was appalling, that it was almost a third of the land area of the province, that it was obtained under the pretext of being agricultural, but even the name of the company involved made it quite clear that it was there for timber. And it was just shocking, and a shocking abuse of what was meant to be a process for getting land available for agriculture, simply to steal what's in the forests.
The Commission found the four leases obtained for the ITNS project failed to provide reasonable access for hunting, fishing, gardening and other necessities of life. Commissioner Moreau says many communities did not discover their land had been leased until he took his hearings to Kiunga. He was particularly touched by one woman who walked for more than a week to have her testimony heard.
There was this woman, she's a nurse and she worked somewhere in one of those remote part of the Western Province or an outfly area. She walked 8 days to come to Kiunga when she heard we were in Kiunga and holding our hearings on the SA bill. And she came in and she gave her evidence and she cried and said, look, nobody told me about my people, about the lease itself and why, you know, our lease is involved. We had no idea about the SA bill process. Now our land is with the company.
The ABC sought a response from Independent Timbers and Stevedoring. Its CEO, Neville Harsley, issued a statement saying that ITNS has not been able to review all the Commission's sources.
The company has requested all of the supporting documents, transcripts and other related exhibits from Commission of Inquiry sources, as they have not been made readily available.
The statement sought to distance ITNS from other logging operators.
ITNS distinguishes itself from many of the other developers listed in the Commission of Inquiry by the simple fact that operations have not commenced.
For many landowners, the fact that their forest is still intact has given comfort, but it's clear the company is keen to proceed with what could become Papua New Guinea's biggest ever logging project.
IT&S has been working methodically in collaboration with landowners for over the last 10 years. IT&S remains committed to the customary landowners through the course of the project, which will provide the local communities with access to medical resources, water treatment plants at villages, schools, community centres, infrastructure, job opportunities and significant landowner benefits and royalties.
Across Papua New Guinea, the Commission identified 66 flawed leases. Last year, Prime Minister O'Neill told Parliament drastic action is needed. As yet, not one lease has been revoked.
And with that, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Parent wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone, and have a great weekend.